So I want to break down the talk, or this afternoon, into two parts. The first part, we're going to look at cancer in our society. Now, I've called it Cancer in Our Society and Why It Scares Me. We're going to look at why are a lot of people afraid of cancer? Should you be afraid of cancer? And cancer today, how it's being addressed, what options do we have to treat it? And then we're going to have a little break, and I want to move to a more positive note, being some of the natural treatments that God's given us for cancer. We're going to look at, has the medical establishment got the answer to cancer? And we're going to ask that question. And then really, it's up to yourselves to make your own minds up based on the evidence that we have in front of us. And then secondly, we're going to ask the question, has God got the answer to cancer? So we're also going to have a look at some stories of people and case studies that have had cancer and that have beaten their cancers naturally. Now, just want to tell you a little bit about myself and why I'm actually here in front of you talking to you today about cancer. The story with me was with my father and my father's cancer. If we go back to 1997, basically my father was diagnosed with colon cancer. He went to the hospital, they said, "You got colon cancer, but that's okay." They said, "We can cut it out." So he had the operation and they cut it out. And they told him, "Mr. Rodriguez, we got good news. We've cut it out and we got it all." And back then, I knew nothing about cancer. Well, we did what the doctor said, which was surgery. So surgery it was. Now, 2 years after that, in 1999, for one of my dad's routine checkups, he went in and they said, "Mr. Rodriguez, we've got bad news for you. You've got liver cancer." So he started off with colon cancer, yet they got it all, but somehow it came back, and they said, "It's come back in your liver, two large tumours in your liver." So we all were there with the doctor, and we said, "Okay, what does that mean?" They said, "You've got 12 months to live, 18 at best. You know, go home, get your things in order, and basically prepare to die." So it was at that point that I just thought, there's got to be more to it than just that. There's got to be something that somebody can do. I asked the doctors, I questioned them, I said, "Haven't you got any treatments? Can't you treat it in any way?" They said, "Yeah, look, we could do chemotherapy. Radiotherapy we don't think would do much. But chemotherapy, look, he could benefit from it." I said, "Well, what are the chances of his rate of survival? What are the chances of the effectiveness of the chemotherapy?" And I said, "Oh, very skeptically, about 10 to 20%. And I said, "10 to 20% really?" And I just thought for a moment, I thought, "Are you sure?" Because, you know, we're going to make a decision on chemo based on a 10 to 20% chance that he's going to get better. And he said, well, he was honest, he was a good doctor. He said, "Actually, be probably closer to zero." And I thought, okay, well, that answered our question. We weren't going to go the chemotherapy way. So from there, I just thought, "Lord, there's got to be a way. There's got to be, I refuse to believe there is nothing naturally that can be done to treat cancer. I just refuse to believe it." And then from there, I just started researching and looking into books, jumping on the internet. And I came across a particular therapy, which I'm going to speak in a little bit more detail later, which was natural. And some of you may have heard it, may have not have heard it, which was called Laetril, also known as vitamin B17 or amygdalin, which is derived from apricot kernels, of all things. And I did the research. The more I turned, the more evidence I found around the world that this was a very effective treatment. And we put Dad on this treatment, and Dad's tumours basically disappear. His cancer dropped dramatically, and he was doing really well. He went for one of his routine checkups, and the doctors would just be amazed. They'd say, "What are you doing? Wow, look at the results. Whatever you're doing, keep it up." We never told them what we were doing. And they just said, "Look, keep it up. We don't know what you're doing." But my dad, being a typical stubborn Spaniard, would he stick to his diet? Would he stick to his therapies? No. He'd get the good news, and for him, that was a excuse and a reason to party. This is a man well into his 70s. And Spaniards like their wine. As you heard earlier today, Spaniards love their pork. And for Dad, it was wine and pork and meat all over again. So 3 months later, when he goes back for his checkup, the doctor with a frown says, "What have you been doing? Your cancer levels have skyrocketed again. Your tumours are back. And, you know, things aren't looking too good." He'd get a scare and then back on the treatment, back on the natural therapies, the juices, the diets. And he'd go back, good news again. And this went on for years, up and down like a yo-yo. Having said that, after seeing the results that my dad got and the further study that I did and research on this particular type of natural therapy, I just thought Australians knew nothing about it. And what you see there is a website that I put up several years ago. And through the website, we just educate people about nutritional therapy, and in particular this particular one, which is called Laetrile. But as I said, I speak to cancer patients and people with cancer every week. They come to my house, we talk over the phone, we talk, and I tell them all the same thing. This is not a magic bullet. If you don't look at making changes in your life and take up a good nutritional diet, and we try to explain to them the eight laws of health, and God's plan, as you saw it this morning, basically this is a waste of time. And that is the most important factor, what you eat and following God's plan. So that's how I got involved with cancer. I've been researching since basically cancer now for about 8 years. And some of the things I've learned over the years is what I want to share with you today. So who here fears cancer? Anybody fear cancer? Our society seems to fear cancer. Generally we have a fear of the unknown in general. Things we don't know about scare us. With me, I always get a little bit spooked when I fly, if I ever have to fly. Why? Because in my mind, I want to know, how does the plane work? How does the mechanic work? So I'm in the IT profession by nature, and I'm very technical. So I need to know every technical intricacy of that plane. I want to know what's keeping it up, the potential and the probabilities of it coming down. What happens if this happens? What happens if that happens? So for me, I have a fear of cancer. A fear of flying. But for most people, they fear cancer for the same reason, because in society we're told we don't know what causes it, we don't know why you have it, and worst of all, we don't know how to treat it. And there are people out there, and there are women, which is really sad. This is very common in America. Women will have double mastectomies. Perfectly healthy women will have double mastectomies simply because they're scared of cancer. They don't want to get it. And breast cancer is one of the biggest killers, not just in Australia, but over in the US as well. It's really taking a lot of female lives. So women are going out and having double mastectomies. So there is a big fear of cancer in our society. Now, these figures come from the Cancer Council of Australia, and that is one in three men by the age of 75 will contract cancer, and one in four women will develop it by the age of 75. Now, by the age of 85, it's one in two men. And Sam mentioned that at the beginning, but by the age of 85, the statistics are showing one in two men will contract cancer and one in three women. Now, that's one of the things. We see it in society. It's very prevalent. That's one of the reasons why a lot of us and society in general, they fear cancer. When people go to the doctor and the doctor says, has to tell them the bad news, I'm sorry you've got cancer, it's like a death sentence. People believe they're actually going to die. And it's at that moment that the person starts dying. The moment they're told they got cancer, because that's what they're led to believe, that they're going to die. And that is wrong, because it's not the case. Now, if I was taking this talk 2 years ago and I asked you, what's the biggest killer in society today? What do you think would have been the answer 2 years ago? Heart disease, correct. Heart disease 2 years ago was the biggest killer in society. Now it's cancer. And that's why people, and we generally, fear cancer. It is the biggest killer in society today. It's the biggest killer in the US and the biggest killer in Australia. In 2006, almost 500,000 people in the US died of cancer. Now, in Australia, the Cancer Council's CEO, Professor Ian Oliver, says, cancer is this nation's biggest killer, talking about Australia, and it should be an election issue. That's how grave he sees it. He states that over 100,000 people will be diagnosed with cancer each year, and this year, approximately 40,000 Australians will die from cancer. So it's something that's serious, and it's something that genuinely, if we don't understand God's plan for health and God's laws of health, we should, and we generally will fear it. Now, heart disease is the second biggest killer, and number three, Western healthcare. I won't touch on Western healthcare again because we've discussed that on many occasions. Western healthcare, known as iatrogenic disease, they've actually given it a name, is the third biggest killer. And that generally means you went to the hospital or you saw your doctor and they gave you a script and it basically killed you, or they did something that they diagnosed or misdiagnosed killed you. And I think it's no accident. You might notice some of the symbols there on the screen. We have the AMA symbol and a pagan symbol right next to it. And I just want to draw just the similarities between the two snakes wrapped around the pole, both in the pagan symbol and the AMA symbol. And I look at that every time and I just think that is by no way no accident. As we're going to see, the AMA, whether it be the Australian or the American Medical Associations, they're all linked with pharmaceuticals. And the pharmaceuticals look towards the government bodies and places like the AMA to approve their drugs, but when you look at who works at these places, they're staffed by ex-pharmaceutical people or pharmaceutical people taking on volunteering positions. So what they're doing in essence is approving their own drugs, and I think that's wrong and I have a big problem with that. But let's now ask the question, what causes cancer? Does anybody know what causes cancer? Sorry? Rogue cells, okay. Any other ideas? Rogue cells, partially correct, actually. Does anybody know how to prevent cancer? Sam might know, because Sam might have been around in this time, back in 1931. We actually gave a Nobel Prize to a gentleman because he discovered what caused cancer. He actually wrote a paper. He was awarded the Nobel Prize for a paper called The Prime Cause and Prevention and Treatment of Cancer. So in 1931, the Nobel Prize was given for the discovery of the cause for cancer. And that was given to Dr. Otto Warburg. And he was awarded the Nobel Prize for his paper, Prime Cause and Prevention of Cancer. Now, what he spoke about was something called anaerobism. And that's simply, if you drive the oxygen out of a person's body, it will become acidic and henceforth cancer will thrive. And cancer thrives in an acidic body system. It's only when we stop and breach the laws of health and God's plans that our bodies turn from being alkaline, which is what they should be, to acidic. And that's where cancer and other diseases start to form. So if we look at history, we find that Dr. Otto Warburg discovered it back in 1931, that cancer was a result of a lack of oxygen in the body. And as we said, it's a condition that he termed anaerobism. Now, he showed that acid in the body's fluids, known as acidosis, expels oxygen from the body and thereby inducing cancer. Now, he was able to prove this by inducing cancer in over 40 different species of animals within 3 days. So what he did was he would inject these animals with acids, which were along the consistency of body fluids, but make the animals acidic, and within 3 days, every single one of the animals contracted cancer and tumours started to grow. He would walk up, he'd say, I can give anybody cancer in 3 days, simply by doing that. And then he would reverse the process by oxygenating the body, and he showed that, how to oxygenate the body, and he proved it, and we awarded him the Nobel Prize. So most of us didn't know that Nobel Prizes were awarded for the discovery of what causes cancer. Did you guys know? No. But yet, we know that in theory, what causes cancer, in theory, how to prevent it, yet after trillions of dollars spent on cancer research over the last 30 or 40 years, okay, we are no further in supposedly finding out what causes cancer. We're not told anything to do with health. You won't find God's laws of health in the media. You won't find them. Okay, New Start, which we've talked about, nutrition, exercise and so forth, you just won't find them in the media. So how do we become acidic? What makes us acidic? The answer's pretty simple. The food we eat and the lifestyle we live and the environment we live in. So how do we become alkaline? What do we need to change? Same thing. The food we eat and the lifestyle we live and the environment we live. As you can see there on the slide, you've got an example of acidic foods and a poor lifestyle environment, and then you've got your alkaline foods. And a nice picture there of a natural environment and natural lifestyle. And that's what we were designed by God to do. Now, Your body's pH level has been called your picture of health. Every single cancer patient is acidic. Now, pH stands for potential hydrogen. The potential hydrogen scale ranges from 0 to 14, with 7 being neutral. Anything under 7 is acidic. Anything over 7 is generally alkaline. Now, the pH of a healthy person's saliva is generally around 6.8 to 7.4. Someone who's mineral deficient or is sick or has cancer will generally find the pH of their saliva somewhere between 6.6 down to about 5.5, towards the yellow end of the scale. A reading anywhere around 6.8 to 7 is generally excellent, and that's what you're looking for. So to put all this in a perspective, someone who eats a typical Western diet can pretty much expect to be in the acidic range, okay, and they're going to be down the lower range, around 6, 5.8%, which is not a good place to be. Yet someone that eats a natural, healthy, alkaline-based diet is going to be around the 7 to 7.2% mark. Now, what you need to remember is that's actually a quite exponential scale. You won't see it there, but to get from, say, hypothetically, from 6.4 to 6.6, there's like a factor difference of 10. But as you get closer to alkaline, the factor starts to exponentially increase. So from 6.6 to 6.8, you need to be 100 times more alkaline than the previous one. 7 to 7.2, it's almost 1,000 to 10,000 times more alkaline. So getting alkaline, once you become acidic, is not something you can do overnight. And the older you get, the longer it takes as we get older, because our bodies, once they're acidic for quite a while, it's not something that's quite easy to become alkaline. What are your thoughts? Do you feel you're acidic or alkaline? Because I want to do a quick practical test. Who wants to find out? If I can, is Oscar and I think Quinton around? What I've got here is a simple saliva test. It's a pH test. Now, this won't be all that accurate, but it'll give you an indication, simply because we've all eaten not long ago. This ideally works 2 hours before or after eating something. But all you've got to do, if you take a couple of strips, so you can try it a few times, wet a little bit just with saliva in your mouth and watch it change. And it will change within the first 10 seconds, the colour, but try to have a look at the measurement almost immediately and compare it at the chart. Where you want to be, ideally, okay, is towards the darker side. Okay, green, as you can see, I don't know if you can see from there, that's a greenie, and it'll turn purple, and that's 6.87, which is alkaline. If you're yellow, you need to come to these meetings a little bit more often, because that's showing signs of alkalinity, of acidosis. Yep, that's where you want to be. If you come up purple straight away, you're very much along the alkaline level. Can you be too alkaline? You can. There are situations, and people can find themselves with what's termed alkalosis, where you're too alkaline. But generally, if you're following God's laws of God's plan of health, you will be alkaline and you'll find that you're healthy. Diseases generally will not touch you. I remember doing this with a friend at work. He was in his 50s, and I'd test him every day to see if, firstly, to show him, to try and get him to do something, because this friend at work, he was a little bit of a burden to all of us. This was about 4 or 5 years ago, because he was always sick. And we worked in a team environment, and because he was always sick, we always had to, you could say, carry him along and always pitching in for him. So as a friend, I try to talk to him about health. He kind of seemed interested, but I try and show him with the pH test, and it was like as if he didn't lick the paper. See how the litmus paper is yellow? It was like he didn't lick it. He would lick it, get the saliva, and it would just remain yellow, yellow, yellow. He was highly acidic. And if you saw what he would eat and what he would drink, he drank 2 cans of Diet Pepsi a day religiously. He had his box, and he used to say, "That's my drink, religiously, my 2 cans of Diet Pepsi." And he had so many. While I was working there, he suffered a stroke where half his body was paralysed. He did come back after several months off work, and yet he still, his 2 cans of Diet Pepsi. And I dare not, I need to make touch with him to see where he's at, but you're almost afraid to, because, like I said, highly acidic, and if you saw what he drank and ate, you'd be quite, you were quite concerned. So if we're awarding the Nobel Prize for the discovery and cure of cancer, the question is, one, why don't we know about it? And two, if we do know about it, why aren't we looking into finding how we can put this into practice? Why aren't we looking further into it? Why isn't these billions and billions of dollars of research that the pharmaceuticals do, who come up with the treatments for cancer, put into alkaline, being alkaline and being acid? And the reason is simply because cancer is big business. In most Western countries, it's illegal to offer any kind of treatment that's based on anything natural. You can't do it. In the US, you try and treat someone or patients with cancer with any kind of natural treatment, you'll go to jail, you'll be fined, and you're basically persecuted. Eventually, most people end up that go down this track of treating cancer patients naturally successfully tend to go over the border to Mexico, and they've got to set up their clinics in Mexico. Doctors in the US, and only doctors, are the only ones allowed to prescribe and treat treatments for cancer. And generally the treatments of choice, as we know, are chemotherapy, radiotherapy, or surgery for their patients. The cancer industry, friends, is worth hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. There are more people making a living out of cancer than are dying from it. Now, just have a look at this article. It's called Strange Medicine. Why are the new cancer drugs so expensive? Now, this article writes there, and I've circled in red, for years we've been hearing about the magic bullet drugs that will expand cancer treatment beyond the long-standing triad of surgery, radiation and chemotherapy. So the article's saying for years we're waiting to hear some good news. For years we're waiting to hear what every man is yearning for, and that is a cure or a treatment for this dreaded disease. But yeah, the article asks, strange medicine, but why are the treatments that we do have so expensive? And I just want to run through a few of them. Erbitux, which is a therapy target for colon cancer, and these are US figures, costs $17,000 a month. Zevalin is a $24,000 a month treatment for a relatively rare type of lymphoma. Avastin is targeted therapy for colon cancer and costs $4,500 a month. A year's treatment with another drug called Revlimid is used for myeloma, and that can cost you over $60,000 a year. Now, when that drug, Revlimid, is used in conjunction with another new cancer drug called Velcade, the annual bill easily soars over $100,000. So why are these drugs so expensive? It's hard to know exactly why. The article says, since drug pricing is a sacred prerogative protected by acts of governments and Congress in the US, the details remain shrouded in trade secrets. But the simplest answer is that drug companies can charge whatever they want. And that's what the article leads to. Now, this is the Herald Tribune in the US, says, a cancer drug's big price rise disturbs doctors and patients. And the article reads, on February 3, Joyce Elkins filed a prescription for a two-week supply of nitrogen mustard, a decades-old drug used to treat a rare form of lymphoma. The cost was $77.50. Now, on February 17, Joyce Elkins, who, by the way, is a 64-year-old, it's the same lady, a 64-year-old retiree who lives in Georgetown, Texas, returned to a pharmacy for a refill, like she had done, and expecting to pay only $77.50. But this time, following a huge increase in the wholesale price of the drug, the cost was $548, and I like this, and 1 cent. I don't know how they price these things, but from $77, the drug jumped within a few weeks to $548. The reason being Merck, which from memory I think is the largest pharmaceutical in the world, who makes the mustagen, as it's called, sold the rights to manufacture and market it to another pharmaceutical called Cosmogen. And Cosmogen, to Ovation Pharmaceuticals. And Ovation Pharmaceuticals, they're only a young company, young pharmaceutical company, and they actually buy slow-selling drugs from the big pharmas. So you've got, it's like a little niche market. You've got this young company that says, well, we'll buy all the drugs that the big pharmas really aren't too interested in, because they don't make that much money, and we'll just hike the price. And that's what they do. It's all about money. Sydney Morning Herald, coming back home. Cancer drug to hit the shelves, but at what cost? Now, this is talking about cancer vaccines, and that's the latest and the greatest from the big farmers, and get ready because you're going to see more of it. All of a sudden, vaccines for all sorts of cancers are going to start appearing and popping up. This is about the wonder drug called Gardasil. I don't know if you heard it on the news a few years back. It was actually an Australian team that supposedly discovered over 15 years and have put together this wonderful vaccine called Gardasil. And this article says, this discovery is one of the biggest success stories of the local biotechnology industry, but it's gone well beyond the Australian laboratory. It's been caught up in the secretive juggernaut of the global pharmaceutical industries, which could make up to $3 billion a year from it. Now, when the discovery returns to Australia as a finished product, the Sydney Morning Herald says, on August 28, 2006, it will bear a retail price tag of $459 per person, believed to be the most expensive vaccine ever. The vaccine's list price on the PBS, the Pharmaceutical Benefit Scheme, has not yet been determined, but others on the scheme cost no more than $40. So you've got vaccines, maximum price $40, and then jumps up to Gardasil, $459. So the article goes on to ask, so what do Australians basically, what are they really getting out of this deal? But what they're forgetting is, let's just take a look at Gardasil. It's a vaccine for cancer, which is targeted at, for cervical cancer, targeted at girls of around 12 to 13 years as they're entering their high school. Now, the vaccine to date has caused 3 known deaths. It's got something like 2 pages of side effects, and it's an area of controversy at the moment because there are 100 reported strains of the virus that cause supposedly cervical cancer. So they're saying, okay, you've got 100 strains of this virus that cause cervical cancer. How many does Gardasil actually protect against? 4. Okay. For some parents, they say, well, that's at least 4 strains we're protected against. Let's vaccinate our girls anyway. But then that brings up the issue of those 4 strains, how do you actually get them? 4 strains of the virus. How do you actually get them? How do you contract it? Through an STD. So they're saying, well, why are we giving our girls, 11, 12, 13-year-old girls, this vaccine, which really they would only get it through an STD? And it's just another way that the pharmaceuticals, just to make money, $3 billion expected in its first couple of years a year that it's going to make. And if you want to find more about Gardasil, I don't want to spend too much time on it, just Google, jump on the internet, Google Gardasil and side effects, or Gardasil and dangerous, and you're going to get story after story after story, news article, video after video of documentaries showing the horrific side effects that this has. Hallucinations, just to name a few, paralysis, okay, just to name a few, but, Professor Ian Fraser, he's sitting there smiling because his team's come up with it and they're going to make a lot of money out of it. Does it work? Who cares? Let's sell it. That's the attitude, and it's terrible. Well, we all know cancer drugs are expensive. Chemo and radiation are generally the treatment of choice by doctors. And why? Because they make a lot of money. But we have to ask the question, how do they work? How effective do they work? And to do that, I just want to have a little look at the history of cancer. Now, having a look at drugs in the treatment of cancer, we find that in 1971, President Nixon waged war on cancer. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I've found out that whenever a politician wages war on something, you only get more of it. Whether it's a war on terror or a war on cancer, you're just going to get more of it. So where are we now? Basically, 35 years later, the war on cancer is still raging, and quite frankly, friends, it's not just out of control, it's been lost. Yet the pharmaceuticals will spin it round, and they'll spin it round with marketing. They spend a lot of money on marketing and TV ads to show you that the war is actually being won. And how do they do that? They'll tell you they've got vaccines, or vaccines are coming. They'll tell you cures for cancer are around the corner. You can't go to a single shopping centre now these days where you haven't got I don't know whether they're students or foreigners from overseas trying to get money for cancer research. Okay, the worst thing you can do, support charities, but anything to do with cancer research, you're wasting your money. Because they're just going straight to the pharmaceuticals for research to make toxic drugs like Gardasil. They'll tell you, we've got a magic bullet. There's a magic bullet coming and we're only 10 or 5 or 15 years away from the cure of cancer. Just keep giving us money. Keep supporting. Keep researching. Now, there are a lot of good charities out there to do with cancer, like the Kids Cancer Foundation. By all means, support those. Starlight. They're all great because they're looking after the kids. Make-A-Wish Foundation, which I think Tom Emanuel supports. You know, support those because they're not necessarily supporting research. They're supporting the kids and the victims with cancer and helping them deal with it. But anything to do with cancer research, stay away from them. Don't support them. So basically, the pharmaceuticals, really, they're just going to spin lie after lie to seduce the entire world. Now, in the US, these days, you can't watch TV without seeing a TV advertisement for some kind of drug. And they're all, I'm glad that I don't watch TV. I haven't for a long time. I don't know if they've got them here, but I'm pretty sure they don't. I'm glad in Australia we don't have those drug ads, because drugs in America, in terms of prescription medicines, they're just part of everyday life. Just about every American these days takes them. So every few years we hear, whether it's the news, whether it's in print media, whether it's in the newspapers, the big pharma, they justify their billions of dollars spent in their research by making promises. All have the same promises. New breakthrough discovery. In 10 or 20 years' time, we may have the cure. Just keep the research dollars coming. If you have a look at the Time magazine on the screen there, it says, Time, there is new ammunition against the war in cancer. Cancer, these are the magic bullets. And it talks about a revolutionary new pill like Glivec to combat cancer by targeting only diseased cells. Is this the breakthrough we've been waiting for? And this magazine, by the way, is dated 2001, 7 years ago, and I don't know, have you heard about these magic bullets that treat cancer? I haven't. Just going to read to you page 54, which I thought was interesting. It says, 8 years ago, there were 124 medicines, so that would have been in the early 90s, 124 medicines in the research pipeline being tested as potential anti-cancer agents. Today, there are 402. So it's 402 drugs back in 2001 with potentially showing promising signs that it could treat cancer. Today, you can't put a figure on it. There's that many drugs being tested for supposedly as a cancer cure. Now, there are a few doctors and scientists who are not afraid to stand for the truth. And I just want to read you some of the quotes from doctors who actually apply the cancer treatments and have actually come out and told it really how it is. Oncologist Albert Braverman, MD, Professor of Oncology at the State University of New York, wrote in 1991 that no disseminated neoplasm, that is cancer, incurable in 1975, is curable today. Many medical oncologists recommend chemotherapy for virtually any tumour with a hopefulness undiscouraged by almost invariable failure. Alan C. Nixon, PhD, he was the past president of the American Chemical Society, wrote, As a chemist trained to interpret data, it is incomprehensible to me that physicians can ignore the clear evidence that chemotherapy does much, much more harm than good. Dr. Ralph Moss writes, Effective cancer treatment is a matter of definition. The FDA defines an effective drug as one which achieves a 50% or more reduction in tumour size for 28 days. In the vast majority of cases, there is absolutely no correlation between shrinking tumours for 28 days and the cure of the cancer or the extension of life. When the cancer patient hears the doctor say effective, he or she thinks, and logically so, that effective means it cures cancer. But all it means is temporary tumour shrinkage. So generally what that's saying is when a doctor tells you that there's a new drug or a new trial that effectively treats cancer, all they're saying is that it will blast the tumour, it'll reduce a tumour. And to make no mistake, radiation and chemotherapy will kill tumours. It'll blast them and it'll put them down. But as we're going to find out, the tumour's not the problem. Now, what do mainstream doctors generally think about chemotherapy? I mean, if you would ask your doctor, what are your thoughts on chemotherapy? What do you think about it? And it's interesting to find out, back in 1986, the McGill Cancer Research Centre, they sent a questionnaire to 118 doctors who treated lung cancer. More than three quarter of them actually recruited patients and carried out trials of toxic drugs. So these were doctors that were heavily involved in chemotherapy and trialing it and finding people and writing people up to actually trial the drugs for lung cancer. And they were asked to imagine that if they themselves had cancer and were asked which of the six current trials they themselves would choose, what would you choose? What would you select? Of the 79 that responded, of the 118, 64 said they would not consent to be in a trial containing cisplatin, which is a common chemotherapy drug. 58, which is 73%, found all the drugs and all the trials unacceptable. And their reasons were simply the ineffectiveness of chemotherapy and its unacceptable degree of toxicity. So you've got drugs and doctors that are actually giving the chemotherapy drugs, they're administering them, but they themselves, the majority say, if I had cancer, I'm not going to subject myself to the same treatment I give out. And, it's basically because they're ineffective and their unacceptable degree of toxicity. Now, here's an Australian report with the finding that the benefits of chemotherapy may have been oversold and that it's been found that chemotherapy is effective only to the tune of 2%. And, my question is, and it's taken you 35 years to find that out. This was printed in 2005. But if you do your research and you look into it, you'll find that chemotherapy, doesn't matter which research or trial, paper or scientific study that you find, it's generally only 2 to 3% effective. And whenever you do get the occasional rare claim that it's 40%, if you actually look at how they did the maths, you'll find that they did quite a bit of dancing with the figures to get to such high percentages. A lot of the time you'll find they use the word relative, not absolute. And they use relative figures. They say, well, we would expect that of these 100 people in the test on this particular drug, we'd expect two to get cancer. Let's say only one does. Then they'll say, well, one out of the two is 50%. We'll make it effective 50%. And that's what they'll report. Relative effectiveness of 50%. But that means that two out of 100 people were only benefited from the trial. And that's wrong. At this point, we're going to have a look at a video. It runs for about 30 minutes. And then we're going to come back and we're going to look at the more positive side, which is called Cancer Doesn't Scare Me Anymore. If you could play part one of the video, and then we're just going to spend a bit of time looking at God's way. We've heard enough of man's way. We're going to look at God's way to treat cancer.